Good afternoon, Mrs. This is the Dogs Program. The Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday, 12 noon, on the dot, to defend and promote public education. And we usually tell you what public education is and also what it's not. Of course, it's not private education, it's not religious education. It's education which is public in purpose and outcome, open to all children. It's public in access. That is the most important thing. And it should be public in ownership and control. That isn't always the case, but it's pretty well the case. And as well as that, it should also be public in accountability, which it is, which private schools are not. But we are here to defend all of those things because they are rather out of sync these days, out of fashion, particularly in places like America, where they have been very strong until recently. However, the American public school supporters are fighting the privatisation of their system through charter schools and vouchers. And our press release 1058 will refer to a court case which has had a win on this level. Let's hear it, shall we, from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1058. American public school supporters fight privatisation. Court ruling blocks West Virginia charter schools. And this was published in Forbes magazine on the 19th of December. On December 3, Kanawha Circuit Judge Jennifer Bailey issued a permanent injunction that prevents the West Virginia Professional Charter School Board from authorising any new charter schools without the approval of the voters in the county where the charter wants to do business. West Virginia passed a charter school law in 2019. That law stated that charter schools would be authorised by county school boards or, in some rare cases, the state school board. But local elected school boards can be reluctant to open up competing schools funded with the local taxpayer dollars. In fact, the very first application for establishing a charter school was rejected by the county board. In 2021, the state modified the charter law. The bill turned every mention of charter school into public charter school, and it created the West Virginia Professional Charter School Board, a new path for charter authorisation. The board members are appointed by the governor, and they had the power to authorise a charter school anywhere in the state, even if that charter had been previously rejected by the local elected school board. Current members of the PCSB, Professional Charter School Board, include Chair Adam Kissel, a visiting fellow on higher education reform for the Heritage Foundation, and a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education Programs under Betsy DeVos, Senior Program Officer at the Charles Koch Foundation, and Vice President of Programs at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. The board also includes Karen Bailey Chapman, Senior Vice President for the Specialty Equipment Market Association, Chanda Adkins, President of West Virginians for Health Freedom, an anti-vax group, and Latonia Page, most recently a senior executive service member at the US Office of Personnel Management. The board also includes Senator Amy Grady and Delegate Joe Ellington, chairs of the education committees of their respective legislative bodies. The law was challenged in court in 2021 by Sam Brunette and Robert McLeod. Their lawsuit did not challenge the effectiveness of charter schools, but argued that the new approval process violated the state constitution. West Virginia's constitution offers a clear statement about establishing new schools. No independent free school district or organisation shall hereafter be created, except with the consent of the school district or districts out of which the same is to be created, expressed by a majority of the voters voting on the question. Judge Bailey issued a preliminary injunction in 2021, but 2 years later, the state Supreme Court tossed out that injunction, finding that the plaintiffs had sued the wrong people. This new ruling comes from the same suit, with the PCSB added as a defendant. The state argued that charter schools are not really independent school districts, as the Constitution originally intended, but Judge Bailey remained unconvinced. There is no question that PCSB charter schools are free school organisations for the purposes of Section 10 because they are statutorily defined as free public schools. HB 2012 was designed to make PCSB charter schools as independent as they could possibly be and still be called public schools. That was the whole point, to evade county school board authorisation and supervision, as the court's factual findings make clear. The PCSB has remained quiet about the ruling, but Brunette told Metro News Talkline that expects the decision to be appealed. Brunette, a teacher and parent, argued that the lawsuit was not filed in opposition to charter schools. It's not about shutting charter schools down. It's about giving the community and taxpayers in those communities the opportunity to decide if charter schools are right for their community or not. The order prohibits the PCSB from authorising any new schools without the consent of the affected voters. It allows the legislature and governor some time to react to the new reality, but Bailey warns that if the legislature and governor fail to act, she will consider another injunction to shut down the 8 charter schools that the PCSB has already authorised without voter consent. The case has already made one trip to the state Supreme Court, so it seems almost certain to travel there again. West Virginia taxpayers will finally learn whether or not they get to have a say in what schools their taxes fund. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. It's good to talk about win when there's been so many losses lately. But we also need to remind ourselves how important public education is and why we fight for it. I read something very interesting this week. If you want to find out where a person really stands, particularly academics, whether they are for autocracy or for the common good, ask them how they feel about Locke and Hobbes. But that's just a point that you might like to follow up. If you want to look up Locke and Hobbes, you might get what we're about. I would say that the dogs are for Locke because we are for the common good. So let's celebrate traditional K-12 public education with those in America who are fighting for it. Over to you once again, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Welcome to 2026, a new year, a renewed promise. And this is an article on a Substack called Celebrating Traditional K-12 Public Education. And it's written by Greg Wyman, who is a K-12 school superintendent in Arizona, and he's been in public education for 39 years. His passion is education and celebrating all the amazing and positive things happening in our public education system. As we enter a new year, I find myself reflecting on the many cultural traditions used to mark this moment. In Chinese culture, the Lunar New Year is associated with the Chinese zodiac, where each year is represented by an animal. Chinese folklore tells the story of the Great Race, in which the Jade Emperor declared that the first 12 animals to cross a river would each have a year named after him. This legend explains the sequence of zodiac animals. Rat, ox, tiger, rabbit, dragon, snake, horse, goat, monkey, rooster, dog, and pig. And reminds us that time itself moves in cycles, not straight lines. The ancient Babylonians are believed to have been the first to make New Year's resolutions. Nearly 4,000 years ago, their New Year began in mid-March, aligned with the planting season. During this time, they made promises to their gods, vows to repay debts and return borrowed items. If they kept those commitments, they believed the gods would look favourably upon them in the year ahead. If not, they feared falling out of favour. These early resolutions were rooted in accountability, responsibility, and a belief that renewal required intentional action. With these traditions in mind, I want to borrow from both ideas as we welcome the new year. The first is the notion that each year carries meaning. The second is the idea that change requires commitment. With that perspective, I believe 2026 should be declared the year of traditional K-12 public education. If I am going to name this year as such, it is critical that I approach it with a sense of optimism and purpose. This sense of hope is because I believe this country may be on the edge of meaningful change, not just for K-12 public education, but for many of the institutions that shape our democracy. This sense of hope is reinforced by a recent observation from Ezra Klein, who wrote in the New York Times that political backlash often signals the beginning of a shift. As he noted, political backlash always seeks the opposing force to the present regime. Closed and cruel are on their way out. What comes next, I suspect, will present itself as open, friendly, and assertively moral. Political tides like ocean tides move in and out. The same is true of the ongoing tension between wealth concentrated in the hands of a few and the enduring push for systems that lift up everyone. The tide may appear high right now, but history tells us it will recede. America's history is marked by periods of extreme inequality, often described as Gilded Ages, which are followed by moments when society recognises the need to re-centre the common good. We have seen this pattern repeatedly, from the excesses of the late 19th century to the reforms of the Progressive Era, from the economic collapse that led to the New Deal to the policy shifts of the post-war years. Today, we once again find ourselves at a crossroads. If this is truly the beginning of another turn in the cycle, then advocates of traditional K-12 public education must be ready to help guide that change. One way to help bring about this shift is to revisit the second New Year's tradition, resolutions. With that in mind, I offer a few resolutions for educators, advocates, and supporters of traditional K-12 public education as we enter this new year. These are not meant to be exhaustive, and I encourage you to come up with your own. Resolution number one, stand up and fight for traditional K-12 public education. If this is truly the year of traditional K-12 public education, then it must be a year in which advocates actively defend all students, especially those who are marginalised. This means standing up for equity, access, and the principle that K-12 public education exists for the common good. It also means being proactive rather than reactive. The vocal minority that has driven much of the rhetoric around education policy is losing momentum. It is time for the silent majority to speak up. After all, 80 to 90% of students in this country attend traditional K-12 public schools. Education scholars Jack Schneider and Jennifer Berkshire provide a critical rationale for standing up to support traditional K-12 public education. In their book, The Education Wars, they provide context for hope and a reason not to be pulled into manufactured conflicts about traditional K-12 public education. Our positive vision for public education is popular, and our opponents know it. That's why they keep manufacturing new ways to sow fear and hate in order to divide us against each other and to distract us. It also means being intentional about where we get our information. Relying solely on legacy media outlets often results in an incomplete or distorted picture, shaped by the billionaires who own legacy media and benefit from undermining public institutions. Independent journalism, often found on platforms like Substack, provides a broader and more nuanced understanding of what is actually happening in our schools. Sharing accurate information from these channels is one way to stand up in this new media landscape. Resolution 2. Reclaim the narrative. I have read several articles quoting scenes from The American President as part of tributes to Rob Reiner. A recurring quote comes from the famous scene where President Andrew Shepard, played by Michael Douglas, addressed the media in the White House briefing room. "We have serious problems to solve, and we need serious men to solve them. And whatever your particular problem is, friend, I promise you, Bod Rumson is not the least bit interested in solving it. He is interested in two things and two things only, making you afraid of it and telling you who's to blame for it." I realised this scene captures a decades-long tactic utilised by critics of traditional K-12 public education perfectly. Make the public afraid of public education and then assign blame. From a nation at risk to debates over test scores, curriculum, wokeness, critical race theory and book bans, the goal has never been to portray schools as dangerous or broken. This messaging was never intended for the majority of families who continue to choose traditional K-12 public schools. It was crafted to justify policies that benefit a small, wealthy segment of society. The school choice movement is about a small group of people making a profit from public tax dollars. The teachers in these schools are still dedicated to their students, but the corporations and owners of these schools have a primary motive. This motive is to make a profit, not to solve the problems with traditional K-12 public education. To paraphrase Andrew Shepard, "Friend, I promise you, the school choice movement is not the least bit interested in solving problems associated with K-12 public education." Reclaim the narrative by reminding everyone of the difference between the school choice movement and traditional K-12 public education. Remind them that the idea of K-12 schooling as a private good, something that individuals do for themselves, is not what the system is about. Instead, K-12 public education is a public good that advances our collective well-being. Resolution 3, don't give up hope. The goal of the critics is to wear down the advocates of traditional K-12 public education. The fight will be difficult, but is worth it for all students. Remember the positives and the importance of your work. The positive impact of public education is real, visible, and enduring. And despite the rhetoric, traditional K-12 public education is not going away. The reasons for that belief will be explored further in next week's newsletter. Gandhi provides perspective when he reminds us that true strength comes not from force, but from perseverance. Change is driven by those who refuse to quit. Resolution 4, be kind. Sometimes the most powerful guidance comes from unexpected places. A quote from Cinderella's dying mother in the adaptation of Cinderella 2015 provides a final resolution for all traditional K-12 public educators and advocates to live by in the new year. Have courage and be kind. Where there is kindness and where there is goodness, there is magic. My wife had her students create a mural on one of the walls in her school. The message was, be the eye in kind. In a world that increasingly isolates people into echo chambers and encourages cruelty behind anonymous screens, kindness becomes an act of resistance. Political leaders often model division and meanness. Educators and advocates must choose a different path. Resolve this year to be the eye in kind. Be kind to your family, your neighbours, your students, your colleagues, and even your opponents. Kindness does not mean weakness, it means leading with humanity. This newsletter is ultimately a celebration of traditional K-12 public education, a system designed to lift up all students and serve the broader good of society. As we enter the year of traditional K-12 public education, we must recommit to the principles on which it was founded. So why am I emboldened with hope as the new year begins? I return to a quote shared by Lauren S. Brown, who recounted hearing Sam Freest speak at a recent conference. He finished his talk with the following statement. I'm a pathological optimist, especially about our democracy. Our pendulum has always swung, sometimes widely, sometimes narrowly. But as long as we, the people and the teachers, keep showing up, we will be okay. That belief captures the heart of public education. Educators show up. Every day they make a difference in the lives of students and shape the future of our communities. Their presence, persistence and belief in young people are reasons for hope. As the political tides shift, that hope gives us reason to celebrate this year as the year of traditional K-12 public education, a year to recommit to a system built to serve all students and to keep the promise of the American dream alive for every child. And that's a dream we could keep alive in Australia too. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. We're not apologising for saying what we really are about, because at the moment in Australia, we are dealing with a writers' festival that's just gone belly up because of warring tribes. And we won't get away from our warring tribes unless we put our children in school together. We can teach our children to learn to live together. So let's have a break, shall we?
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because the next section is very, very, very important for anyone who wants to be an activist. And Dale has got something very interesting for us.
Thanks, Jean. After hearing some of the impassioned voices toward the end of last year, it became obvious that we need to support our teachers in pressuring the government to committing to fully funding public schools now. Also, it begged the question, what can we as a community do to help? Well, teacher Chris Jobe has an idea, and he's begun a campaign called Why Not Now? Chris and I had a discussion about it. So here's our discussion. You are listening to the Dogs program here on 3CR, and we have a special guest. We're chatting with Chris Jobe. So Chris, if you could tell the listeners, you know, a little about who you are and why you're here and what's pushed you to start this campaign.
Sure, sure. Thanks so much, Dale, for having me on the program. I've been teaching in public schools for the last nearly 10 years. I've done quite a few short-term contracts, one-year contracts, and a lot of casual relief teaching. And most of that time has been spent in primary classrooms as either a classroom teacher or a music teacher or a Chinese language teacher. I have taught secondary school humanities and last year spent the first semester teaching teenagers in a remote school in Northern Territory. But my strengths definitely sit with younger kids, and honestly, that's always been the case. I kind of decided I want to be a teacher when I was like 7 years old. For some reason, I ended up at kindergarten with my younger sister one day. I guess it must have been like school holidays, or for some reason my parents couldn't find a babysitter. Anyway, I found myself playing with the younger kids and explaining things and helping them. And yeah, I think I really recognised at an early age, I was at primary school myself, that this is what I wanted to do with my life. It didn't quite work out that way because I found school really, really hard for me because ADHD hadn't been invented yet. So I was that troublemaker. You know, every report came home having the phrase showed potential on every page. So yeah, I was just bored, dysregulated, understimulated, unchallenged, unsupported. And that experience stayed with me as I got into my teaching career because, you know, now I teach kids who've been labelled exactly the same way. But the world of education has learned so much about how to support students with ADHD. Of course, chronic underfunding compromises educators' ability to provide that support. So I ended up dropping out of high school midway through year 12. And then I did the rounds of call centres and worked in the family business in a clerical role. Meanwhile, I was pursuing a musical career. And a decade or so later, had a young family. And one of my bandmates was working for Mini Maestros, which, if listeners are not aware, is an early childhood music program where kids learn the foundations of music through play and movement and singing. So I gave that a go and I absolutely loved it, just seeing kids lighting up and watching shy kids finding confidence and expressing themselves in ways that weren't, you know, really language heavy. They were musical and artistic and creative. It really confirmed that, yeah, this is what I needed to do. So I got myself into a hilarious amount of debt to become a teacher. So what pushed me to be a concerned teacher, I guess, to actually starting this campaign was the realization that no matter how skilled or dedicated teachers are, we're basically being set up to fail. We're working in a system that governments have knowingly underfunded for decades. And back 10 or so years ago, as listeners will probably be aware, they all accepted the Gonski recommendations, agreed on the schooling resource standard, and then simply chose not to implement it. So going forward, after the state election, I was listening to, I can't remember what the podcast was, but Raf Epstein, who I never listened to him, but I know of him. He was on this podcast talking about the rise of far-right politics in outer suburban Melbourne. And yeah, it really struck me and struck him that so much of that anger comes from people feeling abandoned economically, socially, politically. And look, I'm a full politics nerd, right? And hearing Raf Epstein's concerns, he explained it in a really analytical and concise way, and it scared me because I'd also noticed those same trends happening in the outer suburban rim of Melbourne. And so my mission from then on became, how can we, like we being the concerned citizens that don't want Pauline Hanson, Clive Palmer, or any of those other bad faith actors in our parliaments, in a Victorian context, that might be Adam Somyrek and Bernie Finn, how can we ensure that they don't succeed? And how can I do that in a non-partisan way? It may be a surprise to your listeners that an educator found the solution in education. But yeah, it kind of occurred to me that those regions of Victoria that have the greatest educational disadvantage, they're the same communities that the United Australia Party targeted and ended up with a senator for Victoria, which is baffling. His freedom, freedom, freedom campaign really, you know, it cut through to people who were feeling marginalised. Yeah. Fast forward to 2 years after I listened to this episode, I saw on a WhatsApp group that the White Australia Party were leafleting the houses surrounding one of the schools in out of eastern Melbourne that I regularly do relief teaching at. And it's a school where one third of the school population speak a language other than English at home. And it's just shocking stuff. Like, the leaflet was appalling. And if, you know, if I was concerned in early 2023, which I was, well, now I'm absolutely terrified and disgusted, you know, and concerned for what the families of these, you know, these beautiful kids must be experiencing. So I guess the one thing that cuts all across all of that race and background is people's love for their kids and their desire to give them a decent education. So, yeah, I reached a point where I just couldn't keep complaining about the system. I felt that I had a responsibility to try and organise something positive and unifying, and that's where this campaign came from.
Great. So tell our listeners about this campaign.
Sure. The working slogan for the campaign is Why Not Now? And it's kind of simple at its heart. We're asking the federal government to fully fund public schools to the level recommended by David Gonski in his report, but to do it now, not by 2034, which is what the Labor government have promised. What we're going to be doing is starting a paper petition. A paper petition because online petitions, I found this out in my research, have a really short time limit, like I think it's 4 or 6 weeks. And yeah, the goal is ambitious, I'll be honest. I'm wanting the campaign to collect more signatures than any other petition has ever tabled in the House of Representatives. So the previous record was 1,210,471. And yeah, I'd like to aim for an even 1,250,000. And I know that's a huge amount of signatures, but I've done the maths, right? And with the help of, yeah, our friends at the Bureau of Statistics, which is one of my favourite resources, there are approximately 2.6 million kids in public schools across 6,500 public schools, from memory. If each school community aims to collect one signature for each enrolled student, and keep in mind some schools will get less than that, some will get more, some schools we simply won't connect with, but it's really a grassroots campaign. If every school community can get involved, hosting events, tables at school fetes, talking to neighbours, and yeah, really making it visible. And we're also wanting to connect with political candidates who generally support fully funding public schools. So yeah, I guess the petition can be used to put pressure on the government and show voters which candidates are taking education seriously. So as of now, I've spoken to campaigns from the Greens, Socialist Alliance and Vic Socialists, and they're all parties that would have preferred the Gonski recommendations already be implemented like over a decade ago. And they have candidates that are keen to campaign strongly on immediate funding reform. So yeah, I'm very keen for them to encourage voters to ask the government, why 2034? Seriously, why not now?
Absolutely. How do elections fit into this campaign?
In a few key ways. First of all, the petition itself is non-partisan. It's all about the kids and it's all about the schools, not a particular party. It's actually about political will. If we want the best outcomes for our students, our schools need the funds to support that. And the campaign is seeking to involve the largest cohort of Australians that use the education sector, and that's parents and guardians, utilising them to collect signatures and encouraging people to demand more of their elected representatives. And if they're unwilling to listen to 1.25 million plus voters, then why should we vote for them? But it's also by collecting signatures and showing broad community support, we can make it really clear which candidates genuinely support fully funded public schools and which are happy to let the 2034 target slide and which ones are just not interested at all. I guess we're also planning to use the petitions as part of a broader campaign from those left-leaning progressive candidates, which may include independents. I don't know. We'll find out. I'm sure that there are some independent candidates that will be very keen to get involved. It doesn't need to necessarily be the main focus of their campaign. It's just it can sit alongside whatever their other priorities are. But I guess it gives them a way to connect with the community, with parents and teachers. And essentially elections will be a tool to amplify the campaign, just a way to hold politicians accountable and put pressure on the government, because candidates will have to answer to voters about whether they support immediate funding. And if they don't, they have to justify why. And as we get closer to, you know, the federal election, which is a year and a half, 2 years away, I'd like the campaign to start producing scorecards, which have been very effective in the past, that show where the candidates stand, so the community can make their mind up about who's going to look out for their kids' future. Make sure the government can't just quietly push this off for another generation to clean up after.
You've set a huge goal. How do you actually plan to get that many signatures? And what does that make the campaign look like on the ground?
Yeah, it is ambitious, and that's actually kind of intentional. Part of the point is to get people excited, to make it feel like it's a mission that everyone can be a part of. And we want communities to see that working together, we can actually make a historic impact. On the ground, it's really community-led. You know, every school is invited to get involved, and I'd like to make it simple for people to participate, not a stressful endeavour. There'll be a few key roles that, you know, volunteers can get involved in. We'll obviously need people to collect signatures. That'd be the main volunteering help we'd need. But yeah, we'll need school or regional coordinators who collect the petition sheets and enter the data in and help with printing, scanning, storing petitions, getting it back to wherever in Australia they're going to be stored.
If there's a piece of paper that people can sign, I'm sure if we popped one at 3CR, you'd get all the signatures of the volunteers and stuff. So just letting you know, we'd love to take one and leave it at the station.
Yeah, for sure.
How can our listeners get involved and how can they find you?
I'll start by admitting that I am not the world's best organiser, and that's part of the reason that I reached out to you. Yeah, I really need more people on board to make this campaign work. Right now there's a handful of us and we have our skills, but there's a lot of gaps that need to be filled to make this achievable. I've been trying to work out how to make a website and it's partially completed, but if I try and wait for everything to be perfect, it's, you know, we're going to run out of time. So right now the main way to connect is through email. So listeners can write to us, ask questions, and we can point them to the easiest way to start helping. The email is fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me.
fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me.
Fabulous.
Well, this sounds like the kind of campaign that is necessary, especially after that meeting in December last year. The big thing that I got from that was how important it is to support teachers in what could possibly be industrial action this year, and also for the community to take responsibility and to get involved as well. So this is another example of how community activism works for the greater good. So if any of our dogs listeners, anyone who's incredibly good at organising or would like to find out more, contact Chris at fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me. Well, thanks so much for getting in contact with us here at the Dogs and for coming on the program to tell our listeners about this campaign. And thanks so much for actually finding a way to get active about this issue. I really like the title, Why Not Now? Because as you mentioned, these public schools have been underfunded for decades. And even though Gonski was kind of agreed upon, Gonski actually said that this is the bare minimum that a school requires to achieve 80% literacy and numeracy. So it's the bare minimum for not all kids.
That's right. And that's startling that we can't even achieve that. And look, if the argument is that we're short of funds, I'm sure we can come up with many, many ways that our federal government could save money. And I'm sure I don't need to mention them now, but submarines come to mind first of all. Yeah, and maybe the next wave of the campaign is why not 100%? I keep harking back to the Centre for Future Works study from 2023 that talks about how the government can look to eventually saving roughly, I think it was 3 to 4 times the amount of money that it would take to actually fully fund public schools. It would save that money in health outcomes and social security spending and justice system, because that indicates that the actual impact on our students, on our children of underfunding, is that they are more likely to be unsuccessful in finding work. they're also more likely to be unhealthy, and they're more likely to commit crimes that end them up in the justice system. So from an economic point of view, it's a no-brainer. But when you think about where we save that money, where governments save that money, it's a social justice no-brainer as well.
At a protest that the AEU Victoria had last October, there was a social worker who we interviewed, and he was saying that he's really trying to push the whole idea of getting the community behind fully funding public schools, because he wants there not to be a job for him anymore, you know, because
yeah.
He deals with the results of underfunding every day, unfortunately. And this is just off the back of the Victorian government promising to lock up even younger kids, you know.
Yeah.
They can put money into locking kids up, but they can't put money into helping kids thrive.
Yeah, it really speaks to their priorities, doesn't it? Those knee-jerk reactions are about catering to the, you know, the voting.
Yeah, what they perceive to be the larger voting wedge, whereas this would be quite a wedge if we could get this 1.25 million signatures.
Yeah, and that is a ridiculous amount of signatures. And look, even if we don't end up achieving anywhere near that, what we end up doing is having thousands and thousands and thousands of conversations with people and putting pressure on the government through even the perception that we're trying to aim for that, then that can only be a good thing, I think.
Absolutely. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on the program and telling our listeners about it. Good luck with it. I'd like to maybe check in with you in a few weeks' time. We'd like to keep this in the forefront of people's minds because it's such an important issue, and it's great to see some grassroots activism trying to address this need to put pressure on the Vic government and the federal government to fully fund now.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to hearing from listeners. I'm aiming to have some sort of a Zoom meeting to discuss the possible roles that we need filled and how you can get involved and how we can make this a huge campaign. So yeah, please get in touch, and I look forward to hearing from you. And thank you so much for your time, Dale.
You're very welcome. Okay, listeners, when I podcast this program, in the description of the program, I will include Chris's email address. But just in case you want to hear it again now, it's fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me. Me. fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me.
Perfect.
Thanks again for your time today, Chris.
You're most welcome, Dale.
Yes, well, you'll be hearing a lot more from us about the year-long desire to get that 1 million signatures. Let's do it, shall we? But there's good reason for doing it, because our state schools enroll everybody, not just the wealthy. Although some wealthy people still send their children to state schools, but the state schools, our public schools, are carrying the disadvantaged children more than they should, and therefore they should get more money. And there's a census out which shows that in spite of Gonski, in spite of all the talk about funding disadvantage, things have not changed. Inequality endures, and our wonderful producer Dale is going to tell us more about it.
Thanks, Jean. I've got an article from Jonalyn Cueto titled "Census Shows Early Inequality Endures." Almost one in four Australian children begins school developmentally vulnerable, with postcode remaining a strong predictor of educational preparedness, 15 years after national monitoring began. The 2024 Australian Early Development Census, the AEDC, shows 23.5% of children are developmentally vulnerable in one or more key areas, a figure virtually unchanged since the first census in 2009. only 52.9% of children were on track across all five developmental domains measured. The AEDC assesses five domains of early childhood development that predict long-term health, well-being, and academic outcomes. The 2024 results, analysed by the Torrens University Australia's Public Health Information Development Unit, point to structural inequalities rather than year-to-year fluctuations in children's abilities. Geography continues to drive disparity. Children in very remote communities are 40% less likely to be developmentally on track than peers in major cities and are twice as likely to be vulnerable. In the Northern Territory, children in very remote areas are 63% less likely to be on track than those in Darwin. Socioeconomic disadvantage compounds these gaps. Children in the most disadvantaged areas are 30% less likely to be on track and almost twice as likely to be developmentally vulnerable compared with those in the least disadvantaged communities. Family circumstances also shape early development. Children whose mothers have low educational attainment face higher rates of vulnerability, particularly in metropolitan areas. Low income, welfare dependent households are similarly associated with developmental challenges, while financially stable families more often have children who are school ready. Outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children have improved since 2009, with the proportion of developmentally on track rising from 20.4% to 33.9%. However, more than 40% remain developmentally vulnerable. Geography has a disproportionate impact, with 65.6% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in very remote areas vulnerable on one or more domains compared with 38.9% in major cities. Professor John Glover from the Public Health Information Development Unit said the findings required action. Variations in outcomes are strongly influenced by socioeconomic disadvantage, remoteness, and access to services, he said. While progress has been made for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, the overall picture is one of persistent inequity. These data should inform policymakers and service providers to better target support where it is most needed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, but let's have a break, shall we?
Show your solidarity. Subscribe. Go to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377.
3CR. Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because we're off overseas now with our specialist, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. We're going to start this week in Papua New Guinea, where the teachers are not getting paid properly. This article comes from Papua New Guinea Today. PNG opposition blasts government over ongoing teacher entitlement crisis. Papua New Guinea opposition leader James Nomani has accused the government of repeatedly failing the country's teachers, saying more than 63,000 educators serving nearly 13,000 schools have been left to struggle without basic entitlements owed to them by the state. Nomani said teachers could be found in every corner of PNG, from mountain ranges and remote islands to towns and cities, yet their sacrifices continued to be met with neglect through unpaid leave fares, delayed salaries and outstanding retirement and repatriation benefits. He said the problem had persisted for years and could no longer be brushed off as an administrative error, describing it as a deeply rooted failure within the system that had been allowed to continue unchecked. According to Nomani, many teachers are forced to remain stranded during school holidays, unable to return home or relocate, while others fall into debt, simply trying to survive until the next school term begins. He said it was unacceptable for the government to demand performance and discipline from teachers while failing to meet its own legal obligations to them. Nomani called on the Prime Minister James Marape and Cabinet to act immediately, proposing emergency funding within 14 days to clear outstanding entitlements, the creation of a national command centre to process arrears, and strict accountability measures for provincial education authorities. He also urged the modernisation of payroll systems and the protection of teacher entitlements through a dedicated budget line to prevent future delays. Teachers are not the problem, he said. They are the foundation of PNG's development, and if the government cannot honour its basic obligations to them, it cannot claim to be serious about education or the future of our children, Namani said. And that's the end of the article. They sound like very sensible suggestions to try and increase the stability of the PNG education system. We wish them luck with that. Now we're just going to go to a story that came from South Africa. This is from the SABC News by the Director General in the Department of Basic Education, Mathanzima Mweli. A focus on improving schooling, not the 30% pass mark debate. Every year during matric results season, the so-called 30% pass mark debate reignites, capturing headlines and fueling protests. The concern that 30% should not be enough to pass a subject has strong emotive appeal at first glance, but there are three major problems with this line of critique. First, it is based on and perpetuates a myth that standards have been lowered and were higher at some point in the past when our education system was better. Second, the alternative proposal to raise the matric pass criteria to 50% in at least six subjects is a very bad idea if you stop and think about what will happen. Third, and perhaps most importantly, debates about the pass criteria distract us from discussing what actually needs to be done to improve the quality of teaching and learning in our schools. Let me explain each of these three key points. The myth of lowered standards. When critics lament things like slipping standards or lowering the bar, they usually imply or state explicitly that the standards have been lowered, but this is simply false. Firstly, it's important to note that the criteria for obtaining a national senior certificate is more complicated than you just need 30%. In reality, the national senior certificate requires six subjects to be passed, with three at a minimum of 40% and the others at a minimum of 30%. While the exact combination of criteria changed somewhat in 2008, this change did not amount to a clear lowering of standards. In fact, under the old senior certificate system, learners could pass certain subjects at a lower grade level, which required only 25%. But there was never a time in South African history when 50% was required for all subjects to pass matric. A related myth is that universities are now receiving weaker candidates who scrape through with just 30%. In fact, there are other more stringent criteria for university admission. About 84% of those who passed matric in 2024 also met the more stringent diploma pass criteria, and the criteria for a bachelor level admission requires even stricter standards. Specific university courses may also apply additional selection criteria, such as a score of at least 50% in both mathematics and physical science. Okay, you might say, even if standards weren't higher in the past, shouldn't they be? The fallacy of raising the pass mark. The desire for higher standards is understandable, but higher standards are achieved through better learning, not by redefining failure. Simply increasing the pass criteria will not miraculously improve the quality of learning and teaching across South African classrooms. This would be like telling a high jumper to just raise the bar as a way to improve their performance rather than doing the hard work of exercise and improving their technique. But more than being merely ineffective, a dramatic change in the pass criteria would do real harm. Why do I say this? Raising the NSC pass requirements to 50% in at least six subjects would inevitably lead to two highly undesirable outcomes. First, massive educational exclusion. Roughly half of the current matric candidates would pass under such a system, dramatically reducing the number of young people with a qualification. This would be deeply unfair to future generations of youth, result in widespread unhappiness, increased dropout rates in earlier grades, and significant disruption to the labour market. Under a 50% threshold, hundreds of thousands of learners, disproportionately from poorer provinces, would fail matric each year, not because they learned less than before, but because the rules changed. Lowering of standards. It may take a few years, but because of pressure on the system to avoid mass failures, exam difficulty would inevitably have to give. A level of knowledge that previously earned 30% would now earn 50%, rendering the pass mark change a symbolic farce. Ironically, changing the pass criteria would lead to grade inflation and actual lowering of standards. Moreover, universities and employers would lose a valuable range of results to differentiate between candidates. Instead of achieving its intended goals, raising the pass mark would compromise the credibility of the NSC and worsen the sorting of learners into post-school education pathways. A strategic focus on fundamentals. The obsession with pass mark thresholds distracts from the real challenges in South Africa's education system. While the percentage of youths completing matric has improved, too many children still exit the education system without achieving an NSC pass or equivalent qualification at a college, and an educational inequality remains unacceptably high. The more sustainable solution lies in strengthening the foundations of learning so that more children are equipped with right NSC examinations and take key subjects like mathematics and physical science. This is a strategic shift being pursued by the Department of Basic Education and which many academics and critics have been calling for. Instead of obsessing over the matric pass rate or pass criteria, the focus is on better quality early learning. We need to give more children access to well-functioning early learning programs to help improve school readiness. We need to ensure better teaching of reading and literacy in and through home language in the early years of school. We need to improve the numeracy foundations children learn in primary school so that more learners are equipped to take mathematics in matric. Changing the quality of education across thousands of classrooms is not easy. It requires the right guidance to teachers, support materials, and in-service training and monitoring. In a resource-constrained environment, we must invest in specific forms of support that have been proven to raise learning outcomes. A balanced approach. Incremental adjustments to pass requirements could be considered, such as introducing an average pass mark of 40%. However, these changes must be coupled with the development of an alternative educational pathway, such as the rollout of general education certificate at the grade 9 level, and better opportunities of TVET colleges. Drastic changes like a sudden increase to a 50% pass mark would either exclude vast numbers of learners or force a lowering of standards. Neither outcome is acceptable. Raising the pass mark may offer the illusion of action, but it avoids the real work. If we are serious about standards, we must be serious about teaching and learning, especially in the early years. That is where the real improvement begins and where the future of South Africa's education system will be decided. That's the end of the article. I just thought that was a really interesting take on the difference between focusing on marks and focusing on real education outcomes in terms of, you know, people actually becoming competent. And a bunch of young people leaving school with at least the equivalent of a year 12 means that they're much more acceptable in the job market if that's a minimum criteria for a job, for example. And a lot of people mature at different rates. And so it would be totally immoral and wrong for kids to be held back because earlier in their life they tripped over at the year 12 level. I think that's a really, really interesting and thoughtful article. Anyway, with that, I'm going to head you back to the headquarters of the Dogs. Have a really nice weekend. Cheer up.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for all the work you do for us, keeping us informed every week. But now we're going to the best part of our program, our Great State School.
And this week's Great State School of the Week is Mickleham Secondary College. Mickleham Secondary College is a state-of-the-art co-educational college established in 2023, providing education for the students in Melbourne's newest northern suburbs. Mickleham Secondary has a 20-acre campus with an administrative building and library, a general learning and neighbourhood building, a specialist science building, a STEM centre and a community hub with a competition gymnasium. With exceptionally landscaped grounds, it has multiple outdoor sports courts, oval and large playgrounds. The college just received a further multi-million dollar approval for its Stage 2 buildings, including an additional learning centre and arts facility. Currently, with Years 7 and 8 students, Mickleham Secondary is adding a new Year 7 cohort each year and will reach its VCE senior programs in 2027-28. The college prides itself on its vision of co-creating an inclusive, supportive learning community where people strive to achieve their best. Student and staff development is prioritised to ensure lifelong learning is modelled. Employee career growth and development are promoted along with well-being to sustain a positive culture and inviting environment for all. And now some facts and figures from the MySchool website. The current enrolment, 730. and the ICSIA value is below average at 986, representative of a very diverse outer urban community. Students with parents in the upper 25% of incomes make up 8% of the student population. The second level of parental income is 23% of students. The third quartile, which is below 50%, is 31% of students. And 38% of students have parents in the lowest 25% of incomes, with 77% having a language background other than English and 3% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $1.6 million and the Victorian Government of $6 million. Private fees add $83,707 and other private contributions, $86,940. That works out at $20,909 per pupil. The capital, $1.713 million over 3 years. A brand new school with wonderful spacious grounds in a brand new suburb between Donnybrook Road and Old Sydney Road. Back to you, Jane.
Well, congratulations to Micklehem Secondary College. By the way, that college received accolades from the Educator as an innovative school, and it can only go from strength to strength. But these are the schools, these are the children that we have to make sure get full funding from the Victorian Government. And we want to remind you, Dale wants to remind you of a very special email address. Over to you, Dale.
The email address for the Why Not Now campaign is fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me. fullyfundpublicschools@proton.me.
Well, there's one important email address, but here's an important web address. The dog's address is www.adogs.info if you want to find out more about us. But our time is gone from all of us here at 3CR and the dogs. It's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.